I'm Bob Darrell, I'm an alcoholic. Well, we're gonna talk a little bit about our experience with what I've come to believe is the most difficult step, two steps in all of Alcoholics Anonymous, step 8 and 9. In a sense, Alcoholics Anonymous was founded on one man's eighth step. Those of you who know the history of AA, Dr. Bob Smith was 12-step by Bill Wilson, Mother's Day weekend in May, the second weekend in May, 1935. And he fell in love with all the principles of AA. The turning your will and your life over to the care of God, the confession of shortcomings, the helping others. But there was one thing that Dr. Bob would not do, and he would not go out and face his creditors and all the people he owed amends to. And consequently, he drank again. And when he came back from a medical conference in Atlantic City, he was so drunk, he was unconscious, that the conductor of the train laid him on the side of the platform at the Akron station, and his office manager came down and got him, and they eventually took him back to Ardmore Street. Bill Wilson was staying there, and Bill and Ann tried to nurse him back to health, and he was just out of it. And he came to on what most historians believe was early in the morning of June 10th, 1935. And he came to shaken and just terrified and full of remorse, and just hands were like this. And he said to Ann, he said, what day is it? And they said, it's June 10th. And he said, oh, it can't be June 10th. I have a surgery to perform the morning of June 10th. And Dr. Bob was a proctologist, so you can use your imagination what kind of surgery this might have been. And Bill Wilson gave Dr. Bob his last drink and a sedative and set him into the surgery, because he gave him the sedative and the beer because his hands were shaking so much. Imagine being that patient, waiting for your surgeon to come in, and he's going like this. Whew! We should build a statue of that guy somewhere. And we don't know what happened. We know the guy lived. That's all we know. We don't really know anything else. Some of the historians have tried to find out. I mean, I'd like to know. I mean, we know he lived, but did he whistle when he walked? I mean, we don't know. And Dr. Bob got out of that surgery late still in the morning of June 10th, and disappeared. And nobody knew where he was. And he didn't come back that morning, that afternoon, that evening, and finally, almost midnight, he came back to the Smith residence on Ardmore Street, and everybody had been afraid that he was drinking. And he wasn't drinking. He was out seeking out everyone that he ever owed amends to that he could find. And Dr. Bob Smith never drank again the rest of his natural life. And the low estimates is that he helped personally over 5,000 people. And I don't know how many millions of people they helped, that they helped, that they helped. We are sitting in this room today, downline from the two men, Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson. And I think our very lives hung in the balance of Dr. Bob's eighth step. What would have become of us if Dr. Bob would have dug his heels in one more time and said, I'm not going to face those amends? Would he have stayed sober? Would Alcoholics Anonymous have been formed? There's nothing in his experience to lead me to believe that he would have stayed sober, because he didn't before. And that was the one thing he wouldn't do. And June 10th, 1935, he took the bit in his teeth, as it says in our book. And he went out and searched out everyone. And I understand Dr. Bob's misgivings. I was terrified of the amends. I remember sitting in meetings as a newcomer and just looking at hearing people talk about it. I thought, oh, no. That's good for you. Yes, you make amends. Fine. But I lived like an animal on the streets. I mean, oh, my God, if I would have known I had to pay back all that money, I wouldn't have stolen so much. I mean, oh, no. oh gosh, guys, I couldn't. There was guys that went to prison because I squealed on them. There's one guy that I've never found him to this day. I've hired detectives that I took a knife with a blade about this long and opened his chest up. He lived, but he'll never be the same. How do you make amends to those people? How do you make amends to guys that go to prison as a result of your actions? How do you make amends to the thousands of people that just happened to get in my way? Nothing personal. You just went to the bathroom in some bar and you came back and I'd stolen all your money. Or you left your car unlocked and you came back out from work and somebody had taken the radio and the tape player out of your car. Or you left your woman and you left your purse lie down, you turned around, you came back and your purse is gone. And I'm not talking about one or two instances. I'm talking about a way of life. And I looked at the amends and I thought, it's too big. I can never do this. I'll never make it right to my parents. My parents won't ever have anything to do with me again. And I knew that I didn't deserve them in my life after all I'd done to them. But there's a process that permeates the very fabric of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a principle called synchronicity. Carl Jung talked about synchronicity. And a synchronistic universe is a universe that is very accommodating. It's a universe that when you need to go from point A to point B, and you really need to go there, but you can't. The abyss between A and B is something you can never surmount. From the moment of need and desire, with God's help, the universe starts rearranging itself to eventually, in God's time, make the impossible possible. And you don't have to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous very long to hear thousands of stories of men and women who come into AA and the government has taken their children and they will never see their children again. And then 2 years later, they're at a meeting and their kids are there with them. Guys that have been on medications and in psychiatric hospitals for 10 and 15 years that competent psychiatrists will told them, you'll never be off medication, you're never going to be free, you're always going to be mentally ill. And 3 or 4 years later, the lights are on and they haven't taken anything. And they're alive and vital, happy members of society. We see this stuff happen all the time. And it just... In Alcoholics Anonymous, the impossible just takes a little longer. That's all. And I'm so glad that I got to a point where I didn't believe AA would work. I didn't believe these people's notions about amends were right. But what I did believe in is I believed in the hopelessness and futility of my life as I'd been living it. And I was willing to follow some directions. And one of the first amends that I had to make a couple amends that were just terrible in early sobriety. And I wasn't even up to step 8 and 9 yet. But when I got sober, I was facing 2 years in a state penitentiary. And I had been sentenced by a judge to 2 years. And then he gave me a break and put me in a rehab for observation for a while. And if I could do certain things, I wouldn't have had to do the 2 years. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't stay sober. And I went on a drunk, and the minute they threw me out of there, I was on the streets, and I knew that the warrants had been issued. And I started running. And I ran 2,000 miles across the continent of the United States from the East Coast to Las Vegas, and I ended up in a hospital there. And I'm sober not very long at all, and all of a sudden I am haunted by the anxiety of these warrants out for my arrest. And I know it's just a matter of time. And I'm scared to death. And I went to an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm telling him about these warrants. And he said to me, he said, well, kid, he said, you have to contact the courts and offer to go back there at your own expense and to do the 2 years and any other time they want to tack on. And I thought, what, are you crazy? You're out of your mind? You want me to go to prison for 2 years? Hey, I'm sober. I'm not drinking. I'm going to meetings. This is good. He said, listen, kid, you have to do that. No, I don't jail well. I don't jail well. This is not good. No, 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 no. This is not good. He says, you have to do it. He says, do you want to stay sober? yeah, I want to stay. He said, do you want to die of alcoholism? No, I don't want to die of alcoholism. He says, listen to me. How long are you going to be able to stay sober under the anxiety of looking over your shoulder? That you can never use your ID again. You can never get a job and tell them your real name and give them your social security number. Or every time a police car goes down the street, your gut will just go like that. How long are you going to be able to stay sober under those conditions until you will be compelled to drink or take something to take the edge off of that anxiety? Mm-hmm. And when he said that, I thought, crap. Because I knew he's telling the truth. I knew what he's saying is right, but I don't like, this is a dilemma. Dilemma is when you don't like either alternative, you know? It's like live by spiritual basis or die an alcoholic death. And so I said, well, what do I do? And he said, why don't you write your probation officer, PO, write him a letter, tell him where you're living. I said, no, I don't want to tell him where I'm living. He says, tell him where you're living. And tell him in that letter that you're willing to come back there and do any time they want you to do, you will do anything that they want you to do. You just want to be free of this and you want to make it right. And then he said, tell them in the letter that you'll call him. And he said, give him enough time to get the letter. He said, give him 10 days. Give him a time and a date. And put it in the letter that you'll call him at that time and date. And then you must call him at that time. And I wrote the letter and showed it to him. And he looked at it. He said, good, that's a good letter. And I took it to the mailbox and I put it in the mailbox. The minute it went down, I tried to get my hand in there to get it back. I'm like, my head went nuts. I thought, oh, my God, what am I doing? I'm listening. He's never been to prison. Why am I listening to him? Oh, and I was going to leave town. I was just overwhelmed with anxiety now and fear. And a guy said, you can't leave. He said, you'll drink again. So I toughed it out. I tell you, it was the longest 10 days of my life. And the day came and I went to the phone and I'm shaken from fear. And I called his office and this woman answered the phone and she was expecting my call. And she said, I'll put you right through. And she put me through and my PO got on the phone and said, I've talked to my supervisor and we've talked to the courts and you don't have to come back. You don't have to do the 2 years, but there's certain things we want you to do. And you have to report to somebody in Las Vegas and you have to go to these DUI classes and you have to send us money. But it was all things I could do. I could do really fairly easily. And I remember walking away from that phone higher than I've ever felt on any drug or alcohol ever made. And it was like a postcard from God. Dear Bob, we got your back. Love God. And it was the beginning for me of starting to trust Alcoholics Anonymous and ultimately the power that's behind AA that works through the people and the principles here. You see, I'd been around AA for years, but I'd never put my self-interest aside to do anything you suggested. I would only ever listen to you if it agreed with what I wanted to do anyway. And if it was threatening to me or high risk, I ain't doing it. Because I was still at the wheel of my ship. And that was the first demonstration of a willingness, really, that I ever had. And I wish I could tell you that was the worst amends. I've had some even worse than that. My parents... my parents had nothing to do with me. I didn't come from a bad family. My parents loved me very much. But I had battered them emotionally over and over and over again. I can't tell you how many times I lied to them, how many times I disappointed them, how many times I stole from them. I stole so much from them that we have these places in the States that are called pawn shops where you take stuff that you're supposed to belong to. You take it and you sell it or pawn it, and then they hold it until you pay them back. My father became friendly with the guy who owned the pawn shop in that town from buying his own stuff back, right? By the end, the last two or three years, they wouldn't even answer my phone calls. They would have nothing to do with me. One of the hardest things on them is they watched me for a number of years get sober and get drunk. And they would get their hopes up. And then I would go on another drunk and dash their hopes again. And that's a brutal thing to do to someone who loves you. Get their hopes up and then smash them again and get them up until you start losing all hope. And my parents were forced, for their own mental health and their own survival, to cut me out of their life. But they could not cut me out of their heart. And so my father slept 15 or 16 hours a day. And my mother went to a psychiatrist and took medications because she couldn't live with what had happened to her son. And I did that. And I knew that I did that. I wished that I'd had bad parents that I could have blamed and hid behind their bad behavior. I wish they would have beat me, but they never did anything except love me. They weren't perfect, but I always knew they loved me. And so I get sober, and people in Alcoholics Anonymous are encouraging me to start making amends to my parents. And I said, you know, you don't understand. It's too late. It's too late. It won't work. And I thank God the people in AA really aren't big on my opinion about anything, really. They don't really care. They just said, here's what you want to do. You're going to start calling your mother and you don't call collect. First time I ever did that, it blew her mind. She answers the phone. I say, hi, Mom, it's Rob. She goes, Rob, where are you? Are you in Pennsylvania? No, I'm in Nevada. Well, the operator didn't ask me to pay for the call. I said, Mom, I paid for the call. Her voice went up an octave. She went, you paid for the call? She couldn't believe it. All my life, I treated my parents like they were welfare or something, like a sense of entitlement. They owe me. She couldn't believe I paid for the call. They told me to start sending cards and letters and notes and remember birthdays and remember their anniversary and remember Father's Day and Mother's Day and Christmas. What they were encouraging me to do is to act like the son I never was. And when I was a year sober, my parents still did not believe or trust me. Because they had seen me get their hopes up so many times. But they decided to come out to Las Vegas to kind of take a look. And here's the attitude they had. They had, you know, he's probably still a bum. But hey, we've never been to Las Vegas. So that's why they came to Las Vegas. They came out here thinking it was skeptical. And I picked him up at the airport with my first sponsor, Dick, and his wife, Gladie, and we took him out to dinner, and I took him to my home group. And they got to see me with you. And I've never been better than when I'm with you. And they got to see me with the guys that I got sober with, that I kidded around with. They got to see me with the old timers who poked fun at me continually. They got to see the camaraderie. They got to see a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous and how the laughter and the tears and the sincerity and the unified feeling in the room that we really cared about each other. And my parents loved Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't understand it, but they loved it. I mean, they'd sit, to them, it was the most amazing thing they'd ever seen. They'd sit in meetings and they'd laugh when people would say stuff and they'd tear up and, oh my God, she got her kids back. Oh, that's really, it was great. I mean, they loved AA. Right before they left to come back to go back to Pennsylvania, I had my amends list of the financial amends I owed my father. And I went over to the coffee shop at the hotel where they were staying, and I sat down with them and I had my list out, and I owed them a lot of money from all the times I had gone to them and borrowed money when I was in trouble, borrowed money to pay fines so I didn't go to jail, borrowed money to pay the rent so I wouldn't be homeless. And it added up to a lot of money, and I figured it out, and it was going to take me 12 and a half years to pay it back. 12 and a half years. And I told my father this plan, I'm going to start giving you so much a month. And my dad and my mom looked at each other and my dad said to me, he said, listen, Rob, we don't want you to pay us back. This is the first time in years that we had any hope that you're going to be okay. All we want is you to stay sober and keep going to that AA and doing what you're doing, and you don't forget the money. You don't owe us the money. I was elated. It was like hitting the lottery, man. I remember leaving there. I'm on my way to my sponsor's office. I'm on cloud nine. This is great. I don't have to pay. This is wonderful. I thought, I like this amends stuff. This is good. And I started thinking about other people I owed money to. Maybe I could get them to see the light like my parents did. And I went into my sponsor's office and I told him the great news. My dad said I didn't have to pay him. And my sponsor said, I don't care what your dad said. It's your debt. You owe him and you have to find a way to pay him. I'll tell you, if there's ever a time you'd need to change sponsors, it's right about then. And I said, but Dick, what am I going to do? I don't know how. I can't. If I send him a check every month, it's not going to mean anything to him. He won't cash it. He says, I don't know. But if you're willing, I believe God will show you a way. And I worked as a cashier in a store, running a cash register. And my father had one hobby that was almost an obsession. He collected old coins and old dollar bills. And in the late 1970s and even into the early 80s, there was still a lot of the old silver, real silver coins in circulation in the United States. There were still gold certificates in circulation. There were still silver certificates. There were still war pennies, wheat pennies and the war nickels that were part silver. My dad loved all that stuff. He was obsessed with it. He'd sit and read the books and he'd lay them all out on the table. And, it was his hobby. And the inspiration came to me that every day through that cash register, I see some of that stuff. And I went to my boss and I said to him, I said, would you mind if I were to buy this stuff out of the register for my father? And he said, I don't care. I don't collect that stuff. Kid, do whatever you want. And so in 4 years, a little over 4 years, I saved up at face value what I owed my father, what would have taken 12 and a half years. But I'll tell you what happened. From the moment I started to move in that direction, it was like I started to get lucky. And all of a sudden, I'm getting raises and bonuses. And there was a guy in AA who had a little moving business. He'd pay me $100 for 4 hours work, and he'd pay me cash under the table. And all of a sudden, what would have taken 12 and a half years took a little over four. And I was able to give my father all those several thousand dollars in rare coins and bills, and we were even. And I knew he would have to take that. He could no longer not take that than a crack addict could give back an eight ball. He couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. And he took that stuff, and my father died a few months after that. And I was able to go back to Pennsylvania and bury my father and be there for my mother and sister. And I buried him with no unfinished business. I buried him knowing that he knew that I knew that he loved me. I buried him knowing that he knew that I loved him. I buried him knowing that he got to watch me demonstrate that I was different, that I was standing on a different footing, that this was just not, my recovery was not just talk, that I had actually taken actions that impressed the hell out of him. And I in the book it talks about a mere mumbling that we're sorry won't fill the bill. It talks about a demonstration. That's why the chapter where the amends are, it's called Into Action. It's not Into Talking. It's Into Action. And it's about a demonstration. And I'll say a couple more things. I get a lot of guys that I sponsor who are sober a lot of years and their lives are financial disaster areas. And for no apparent reason, because they make a lot of money. They make lots of money. But the more money they make, the more bonuses they get, the more raises they get, the more in debt they become. And it's a crazy thing. And a lot of times they'll come to me and ask me to sponsor them or to work with them because I live a flamboyant lifestyle. I have a lot of abundance in my life, a big house, and I drive an amazing car. And you know, people, it's like they're deluded by self into thinking that they're going to get me to help them and I'm going to show them some kind of trick, some kind of financial trick that's going to make them abundant. And every single case to date of these people who are living in a financial disaster area, we always find out that it comes back to unmade financial amends. And it's usually amends that they got away with not making because someone told them, oh, forget about it. Or maybe the person they owe doesn't know that they owe, but they know. And I don't think you can fool the God or spirit within you. And what happens to guys like me, God wants to give me everything, all the abundance in the universe. The problem is that I have become and rendered myself an unworthy receiver. You see, I always secretly know if I'm even or not. And if there's people over here that I've screwed over and I've gotten away with it, I'm telling you, I haven't gotten away with it. I just think I have. That's what karma is. You know, the literal translation of the word karma into the English would translate as the word doing. You owe some people over here, and your life is crap over here. It's not the universe punishing you. It's you're doing it to yourself, and you're not even awake to it. If you want to see a great ninth step movie, look at the movie. There's a movie called Flatliners. It's about these doctors that were experimenting with death, and they brought ghosts back that are haunting them, and these ghosts are destroying them. And they don't understand what's going on until the one doctor figures it out, that in order to put that ghost to rest, he must go and find someone he had hurt and make it right. And I think that in the realm of the spirit, I think that's what we have to do. We have to make this stuff right. There's no way around it. I wish there was. If I could fool me, maybe I wouldn't have to make all the amends. But I can't fool me. There is always, I'll run over it with justification and rationalization. But in me, there's always been a sense of how I must have affected other people. I may be asleep to that, but that knowledge is in me just the same. And when I wake up to that realization of what I did to this person and how it would have felt, other center myself to how it would have felt to have been on the receiving end of that, then I know exactly how to approach them and make it right. Because it's the same way I would want to be approached if the tables were turned. It's no different. I do to and for you what I would want and wish and desire to have done to and for me. It's all an even playing field here. And you can run, but you can't hide. And I know a lot of guys that are sober a lot of years, and they think they've gotten away with something. They haven't gotten away with anything. Page 127 of the book is a promise and a statement of spiritual cause and effect. And it says something very interesting. It says, for us, material well-being always follows spiritual progress. It never precedes it. I've seen guys make a whole lot of money in sobriety, but they don't have any material well-being. They can't make enough money. And they're never happy and satisfied, and they always are worried about it and trying to get more and more. And I know other people that have lived, that made the amends and paid these people back and really don't make a lot of money, but they're very comfortable and very free of the fear of financial insecurity because they made the spiritual progress. They didn't put the money first. And what's the great illusion about money? Well, how much money do you need? I know. You know how much money you need? just enough so you don't have to trust God. Do you know what you want the dollar amount? 5 crowns more than you'll ever have. Because whatever you have, it'll always be not quite enough. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Carrie. I'm an alcoholic. All right, I'm going to stand on my booster seat. I love it, like I can bounce. I love to talk about amends. This is like my favorite topic of all times. I really like talking about the sex inventory because it makes people uncomfortable. But I like talking about amends because there is no step that I haven't had such a miraculous experience with. There is nothing that has been so instantaneous as the healing in amends. You know, Bob talked a lot about financial amends, you know, and I'm laughing because, you know, I have 3 kids, so I am poor. I'm kidding. But really, no. You know, my husband and I, we're not wealthy. We are, you know, your typical middle-class, working-class Americans, and we have 3 kids, and I live extremely well. And I want for nothing. I mean, I might want a Mercedes, but I have a Kia, and I'm happy with it. I have never gone hungry. I have never not paid the bills. I have never not had the rent. I have never, ever, ever wanted for material things. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and we were talking about amends and talking about finishing the steps, because I'm sort of a stickler. I'm a bit of a brat because I happen to believe that doing 9.5 steps, well, it doesn't really count. In my experience, when it says having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, it means I actually have to complete the steps. And not completing my amends means I didn't complete it, in my experience, according to my sponsor. And since she's right and she knows everything, it must be true. With that being said, you know, I was talking to a woman the other day, and she was telling me, she's like, when am I going to get rid of my fear of financial insecurity? I said, well, how many amends do you have left? And she goes, well, I can't find this one, can't find that one, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I'm talking to her. I said, well, maybe you need to go back to the first step because you're obviously not properly motivated. Because when I was walking on amends, my sponsor put a bottle of vodka and the big book on her kitchen table. And she asked me, what's easier to do? Think about that for a minute. Is it easier to go back and drink and die an alcoholic death, or is it easier to knock on that person's door? I mean, in reality, that's the truth, because if I haven't had an entire spiritual experience as a result of these steps, that's exactly what I'm going to do. When I do 9.5 steps, I do just enough to feel okay for a little while, and that when that runs out, I'm screwed. Because I haven't gained access to the power, I've used the steps to feel a little better. So I have a habit of doing that. I keep a bottle of booze in my house just for that, because I really like to mess with people. So I get a sponsor who's coming over to explain to me exactly why she doesn't need to make that amends or pay that back. And I ask her, I said, well, is that a Louis Vuitton bag? Do you really need to have that bag? You know, do you need to have a Prada bag? Can't, you know, a $5 bag from Kmart be good enough? Can't you take that money for that Louis Vuitton or Prada bag and pay back some of the amends that you owe? And, yeah, but I really like my Louis Vuitton bag. And I say, well, what I want doesn't matter. So what you want doesn't matter. Stop buying Louis Vuitton and pay back your money. But what I like to talk about, and the amends that hung me up, wasn't the financial amends. I mean, I owed a lot of money, and I stole a whole hell of a lot. But I kind of get that I owed people. Like, I get when you steal people's stuff, you got to pay it back. I get that my parents, you know, spent a whole lot of money on me. I was in and out of rehabs and mental hospitals most of my life until I got sober. In fact, I remember distinctly saying to my mom when I went to college, I said, well, you know, because in the States you have to pay for your education. I said, well, Mom, where's my college fund? And she goes, that was your last rehab. And I laughed. I was like, oh, yeah. I was like, Mom, why didn't we go on vacation? because you were in rehab. but the financial amends weren't such a big deal because I really did understand that I owed it. But what I did is I had a rationalization and justification as to why I didn't have to forgive or make amends to the people that I thought harmed me. You know, I'm like Bob. I grew up in a household, and I've said this, and it's no justification, it's not excuses, but I grew up in a household that was very violent. And so when I got sober, you know, there was a part of me that really believed that I was the alcoholic that I was, and my life was a mess the way it was because of what they did to me. Because I'm a very sad little girl, and I was hurt really badly. And if I had a better life and I had the silver spoon in my mouth and all those things, maybe, just maybe, I wouldn't be this terrible alcoholic that I am. You can hear the dripping sarcasm in that. When I get sober, and I still blamed my parents, I blamed my childhood, I blamed my family for what I had become, and I took just enough responsibility to, you know, I'd be like, well, they didn't mean it, but I secretly wanted my family to be different. I secretly wanted them to change. I secretly wished that I had a life that was different than my own. You know, the big book talks about it, and it says in the family afterward, and to the chapter to the wives, it talks about the past being the greatest possession an alcoholic could have. You know, that dark past, that pain, those things that we hide in our closet, that they are the greatest possession, and they're key to life and happiness to other people. I didn't understand that. I still believe that if I had different circumstances in my life, I wasn't grateful for my experiences. I didn't understand that all things in God's world were as exactly as they were supposed to be. That it's not a matter of deserving or any of those things, but I am who I am because of what has happened to me. And I've become what I've become because of what has happened to me. Inversely, I've helped the people that I've helped because of who I am. Because of what has happened to me. So I had done inventory a bunch of times. And you ever make an amends, but you don't really make an amends? You go in and you make the approach and you call up the person, you sit down and have the conversation, and you take responsibility or your part. And I love that Bob pointed that out too. But secretly, you're still pissed off that they didn't behave differently. Because in the big book, it tells us that we're supposed to go to an amends, you know, and we're supposed to be honest, open, and frank, right? It says that we're supposed to not criticize or condemn. In fact, in the 9-step, it says don't criticize all the time. In fact, it constantly says, oh, and to the wives and the family afterward as well, which I really believe if you don't think you owe an amends, read those chapters and go back. And I also use those with my sponsees in the meditation as far as their amends. But that's a whole other thing that I will talk about tomorrow. It tells me in the 9-step, it says that I'm not to criticize. It says that I'm supposed to be honest, open, and frank. So I would go to these amends, and I would take responsibility for what I believe to be my part with my family. But I never really forgave them. I still kind of wish they were different. And I still secretly in my head said, well, if only you were different, I could love you more. And I would wonder why my relationships with my mother or my father or my brothers or sisters always seemed to go badly. And I'd go back and make amends all the time. You know, I would go and I'd have a resentment and my sponsor would have me write inventory and I'd write that inventory and then I'd go make the amends. This was our dance. We did this over and over again. They would see me coming, like I'd have the index card because I used index cards, you know, to write my, like what I did to harm the person. And I would write it and I put it in my back pocket. And if they saw me with an index card in my back pocket, they knew what I was doing. And they just shake their head like, oh, it's time for Kerry to have another one of those conversations with me. God, you know, why can't she just get over it? And I was working with a sponsor at the time, and her name was Cass, and she's a wonderful woman. And she had a daughter my age. And her daughter was an Alcoholics Anonymous as well. In fact, she and I are very good friends. And I had begun to work with her, and I did a fifth step with her. And she was the one who taught me about the whole it's not my responsibility thing. And when I did my fifth step with her, you know, we were talking about my resentment with my mother and my father and my brother. and certain things that had happened in my life. And she pointed out to me, she was like, you know, I have a daughter your age, and I did a lot of the things that your mother did to you. You know, and you seem to be able to love me despite my faults. I'm like, absolutely, I love you. You saved my life. And she's like, how many times has your mother done that for you? How many times has she bailed you out? It's like, yeah, she might have done things that hurt you. She might have turned a blind eye when, you know, my dad was kicking the crap out of us. On the other hand, she also was there for me when nobody else would be. And I stopped for a minute and I thought about that. And I realized that my whole life I was demanding that my parents be, you know, Mike and Carol Brady. You know, I was demanding that my parents be someone else. And then I would wonder why they would be exhausted by me. Why they'd be worn out by being in my company. Because basically every time I'm around them, all I thought was, if only you loved me more in the way that I want you to. And it stopped me and I was like, oh my God. The problems that are happening in my relationships with my mother and my father and my brother are not about them anymore. It's not about what they did to me 20 years ago. It's about what I'm doing to them now. I said, holy shit, what do I do? So I went and I used to, the one thing that pissed me off most about the thing and the thing that I refused to let go with my mom was that she had never said that she was sorry. You know, I grew up and like my dad was really violent and he really did beat me. And my brother was a lot older than me and he beat the living crap out of me as well. And my mom never stopped it and I always hated her for that because I'm like, well, you were the one who wasn't on drugs. Like, why didn't you stop it? You know? And I never forgave her and I felt like she never said that she was sorry. And I realized that the problems that I was having, the spirit, the fact that I was so blocked spiritually, and the resentments and the expectations and all these things that I had that I thought that I let go of, I really didn't. And I went and I made amends to her, for which was actually the final time thus far, knock wood. And it was after having had, you know, having done the fifth step with my sponsor, Cass. And I went to her and I prayed before I got there and I said, God, please just let me love her. Let me love her in the way that I want her to love me. Just please let me love her unconditionally. Just please let me be the daughter that I want to be. And I went down and I sat, you know, I was in the backyard with my mama and I sat down and I said, look, I gotta do another one of those amends. She's like, oh, this is like the fifth time. You know, because at this point I was 5 years sober. I was like, oh man, oh, she's doing it again. And I made amends to her for expecting her to be somebody that she wasn't. And for secretly demanding that my life be different. And she stopped and she burst out in tears and she said to me, she was like, Carrie, I'm sorry you had the life that you had and I wish that I could take it back. And that was the one thing I had waited for my whole life. All I wanted was, I'm sorry. And it wasn't until I was willing to forgive her that she was willing to say it. Because the fact is this, is that when I'm expecting somebody or I'm refusing to forgive, to let go, to be free until somebody else changes, I'm their prisoner and they're mine. But when I was willing to just say, you know, it doesn't matter, I love you anyway, she gave me the one thing I had always wanted. And you know what? I have yet to have had a harsh word with my mother, and it's been over 8 years. Not a fight. And when I start to get irritated, I'm able to say, I think it's getting heated. Let me go, and I will call you back. And I hang up, and I don't yell at her, and I don't say, you're not a good mother to me. You don't love me enough. And she knows that I love her. And when you know what? When she's having a hard time, you know who she calls? Me. Because she knows that I'll listen. Because I was able to, by the grace of God and my sponsor, by the work that I've done, and by being really honest with myself about what was really going on in that relationship, and it had nothing to do with what she did or didn't do, and had everything to do with the love that I was not willing to bring, and the criticism that I had. And the same thing happened with my brother. You know, I went and made amends to my brother for resenting him for beating me. And I did the same with my father. And when I went to go make amends to my father, At first, he didn't want to hear it. He was like, look, I don't want to dredge up the past. You know, he's an Irish truck driver. He didn't want to hear it. He was like, that's uncomfortable, this motion stuff. I don't want to hear it. You know, so I said, okay, Dad. And then every year or so, I'd say, Dad, are you willing to hear that amends? He'd be like, no. And then last year, my nephew has a drug problem and is in prison. And I was trying to help him, or I was actually trying to introduce him to friends of mine to help him. And I was talking to my dad about it because he didn't understand, alcoholism and drug addiction. And I was trying to explain to him about the program. He's like, I don't get that program thing and like why you guys want to talk about the past and this, that, and the other thing. I don't get it. And I was explaining to him, and I started to explain exactly what amends is. That amends isn't about talking about the past, but about taking responsibility, acknowledging the mistakes that I've made in my life, and then making an effort not to do it again. And he stopped. He goes, so that's what you were trying to do with me all those years? I said, absolutely. And I was actually able to, by being of service to my family, make the amends to my father. But he didn't know what I wanted to do because he was so afraid that I was going to browbeat him with his mistakes that he didn't realize that I was coming to him not to expect him to acknowledge his mistakes, but simply to set right my own. You know, and that's been my experience. I've never had a bad amends experience. You know what? No one's ever kicked me out of their office. Nobody's ever told me to go screw. I have always, when I've gone with the right attitude to an amends, had a beautiful experience. It's always been healing, and I've always walked away a little bit clearer and a little bit lighter. You know, I've actually made amends to and been able to set right a lot of the harms that I caused other people. I've been able to pay back a lot of money, and I've actually been able to help other people do the same. And it's been my experience, and this is just for me, in being willing to face who I am, the things that I've done, with the power of God working in my life, that I don't walk through the streets afraid anymore. I don't go to the supermarket thinking, am I going to run into somebody I knew from high school? You know, do I owe that person money? You know, I've run into people that I've come, I don't know about you, but, I did a lot of messed up stuff, and I forget. I mean, I lose track of people. I've been all over, and I've done really terrible things. And, I forget sometimes who I hurt. And then I'll see somebody in the parking lot of, the 7-Eleven or the AMP, and I realize, it's like, whoa, I owe that person an amends. I did that? Or were you ever driving, in your car, and then one of those quiet moments, you remember something really terrible you did? Like something you stole that you forgot about, or a person that you hurt that you forgot that you hurt. And it's like, oh my God, I did that? Oh my God. The fact is this, is that if I remain open and willing to set right the harms that I've caused, and if I remain open and willing to let God restructure the fabric of my life, I see these things, and I'm willing to make amends for them right then and there. There have been so many times when I've run into people that I haven't seen for years that I've said, you know what? I've harmed you. Can we talk about it? Can I get your number? Can we get together? And I've never had somebody saying no. I've never had somebody say, you know what, I don't want to talk to you. I've had people say, I'm not ready to hear your amends. And I'm like, that's okay. When you're ready, please let me know. And when they were ready, they did let me know. I mean, this for me is a beautiful experience. But, I had for so many years what I believed to be, justified anger. I had justified anger against all kinds of people. People who were dead, people I couldn't find. Have you guys ever heard of something called proxy amends? It's when there's somebody who you can't get a hold of, maybe because they're dead, or you've searched for them for, quite a long time and you can't find them. Where you write a letter to that person, and then you read it to somebody who reminds you of that person, and they give you feedback based on what you read. So that, because there are people that I can't find. There are people that have just disappeared. I mean, there are people who probably are hiding from me still. But I wrote proxy letter amends, and I read them to people. And I'm ready whenever I see these people to make amends, because I am very clear on the harm that I caused. I'm very clear. I know exactly what I need to say, and I'm absolutely 100% prepared. But I've been able to, because I did the proxy amends, kind of put that karmic amends back into the universe. You know, and for me, being willing to do that and showing up in that way has made a tremendous difference in my recovery, because I don't have the guilt and the shame and the pain and the crap inside of me that I had. And I have an incredible amount of freedom. You know, and I talk about this alcoholic family, right? And I talk about, you know, you would think that, you know, that my parents are horrible people, and they're not. They're absolutely wonderful people. They're just wonderful people who had a lot of problems. And you'd think that my brothers and sisters and I must be really screwed up, you know. And we kind of, you know, we're, most of us, a lot of us are in the fellowship, so you can kind of say, because we're alcoholics, we're a little messed up. But almost all of us are living on a spiritual basis one way or another. And through me, I went through this process, and I had an experience, and my spirit awoke. And it took a little bit, took a couple times through the steps before my spirit really awoke, because I was very, very blocked. But when it happened and I was really awake, I brought that awakened spirit to my family. I brought that awakened spirit with my husband, because, I mean, we drank together, so I did terrible things to him as well. And, of course, he lives with me, and I do all kinds of terrible things all the time. You know, I'm an inconsiderate, selfish alcoholic. But I brought this awakened spirit to these circumstances, and I'll tell you what. My whole family, you would never know we were the crazy Irish Catholic alcoholics that we were. I mean, there are people who, like, who, my sponsees come to my parents' house and they're sitting down, because my sponsees come to my parents' house and sit down. My family, my parents are a part of my recovery as much as, you know, they're a part of my life. There's not any of that animosity or any of that crap. My brothers and sisters come to meetings. It's amazing to me. The ones who are not in recovery are open to it. The ones who are still active, we help and we don't judge. And we can have, you know, Christmas dinner. We have a Christmas party at my house every year. I was put in the mental hospital 4 times by my parents. My mother had me arrested, and I fought 6 police officers in my parents' living room. And they celebrate Christmas at my house. Think about that for 5 minutes. My mother had me arrested. She was so scared of me, she called the cops to protect her. You know, and my brother, who I fought with like a cat, like cats and dogs, who beat the living crap out of me, brings his kids and his wife to my house and celebrates Christmas with me. Think about that. That's not me. That's not virtue. That's not anything like that. That is the power of God. That is doing this work, having an experience, bringing that experience everywhere that I go. And by virtue, just like my sickness infects other people and makes other people sick, by working this process and doing this and having this spiritual experience and being willing to face myself as myself, without any excuses, rationalizations, demands, expectations, I am who I am. And being willing to bring that into my relationships, I've actually been able to help those around me just by not being a schmuck and bringing love to the table. Can you imagine that? So, you know, I get better and everybody else around me just seems to get better. You know, I expected everybody else to get better so that I could be better. And it turns out it's the exact opposite. You know, and I have, and I'm going to finish it up, but I mean, I have like incredible amends stories. I mean, I share the family ones, you know, because they're really neat. And, you know, you've heard the tremendous horrors of my childhood. And now, like, you know, I love my father to death, and he goes to my kids' baseball games. In fact, he's at my son's baseball game right now while I'm here. I mean, my mom's watching my kids while I'm here. Completely, completely different and exact opposite of what my life was before I got here. But, you know, I've also had tremendous amends experiences everywhere. I mean, I've had amends experiences with friends, paying back money, going back to stores and paying them back, and having the manager look at me and say, okay, well, you stole, you know, $100 worth of merchandise from my store 10 years ago and you want to pay me back? And being humble enough, you know, and then I shop in those stores later. And I smile at them, because you know what? I'm free. I owe them nothing. You know, and doing those things, that has made my life incredibly wonderful. But it's to me an absolute power of God, that not only has he taken, you know, this broken alcoholic who couldn't stop drinking and put me right, but he's also taken the relationships that I damaged because of my own bullcrap and has been able to set those right as well. That the people in my life actually enjoy being in my life. That they're not there because they have to be, because they love to be. And that I could be of service to my family in ways that are, it's incredible to me, you know. And for me, and this is the greatest miracle, that I can give back what I've been given. Not just the money, but the love and the patience and the tolerance and the kindness, you know, that I've been given by others, that I can give it back to my family and back to those in my life and my friends and my sponsees and those that I come into contact with. You know, and this really is what this immense process is all about, because I did not know how to love. I only knew how to want. And by doing this process and being humble enough to go back to people and say I was wrong, I've been able to learn how to love. Thank you.